Let me say just before we read Psalm 9 that as we read it, you may be thinking, well, I'm not sure if that's a particularly helpful passage, because it seems to be saying that if you've got a difficulty in your work team and you've got a toxic colleague, then you kind of what you're going in with is all guns blazing, and you want God to sort of destroy them. I thought Jesus said we've got to love our enemies and all that. So we'll come to how Psalm 9 fits with all that in a few moments, but we need to read it first. And so here we go with Psalm 9, a psalm of David, who was king and who almost constantly throughout his monarchy, throughout his reign, had people who were trying to get rid of him and get him off the throne. So here is what David says. I will give thanks to you, Lord, with all my heart. I will tell of all your wonderful deeds. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing the praises of your name, O Most High. My enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before you, for you have upheld my right and my cause, sitting enthroned as the righteous judge. You have rebuked the nations and destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. Endless ruin has overtaken my enemies. You have uprooted their cities. Even the memory of them has perished. Their desk has been tidied already. The Lord reigns forever. He has established his throne in judgment. He rules the world in righteousness and judges the peoples with equity. The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Those who know your name trust in you. For you, Lord, have never forsaken those who seek you. Sing the praises of the Lord enthroned in Zion. Proclaim among the nations what he has done. For he who avenges blood remembers. He does not ignore the cries of the afflicted. Lord, see how my enemies persecute me. Have mercy and lift me up from the gates of death, that I may declare your praises in the gates of daughter Zion, and there rejoice in your salvation. The nations have fallen into the pit they have dug. Their feet are caught in the net they have hidden. The Lord is known by his acts of justice. The wicked are ensnared by the works of their hands. The wicked go down to the realm of the dead, all the nations that forget God, but God will never forget the needy. The hope of the afflicted will never perish. Arise, Lord, do not let mortals triumph. Let the nations be judged in your presence. Strike them with terror, Lord. Let the nations know they are only mortal. Well, whilst that may sort of sound like something counter to what we're supposed to think if we're trying to understand how Jesus wants us to live, and sounds like a sort of a revenge prayer, then let's understand it in its kind of whole biblical context. Jesus, of course, said, love your enemies. He did. He still does. He loved us when we were his enemies, and one of the ways that the Bible understands not being right with God is actually being his enemy, that there isn't actually a neutrality, there isn't a fence to sit on. So Jesus said, you're either for me or against me. Now, he didn't have some kind of persecution complex, he didn't have a sort of a warped and twisted ego that spots conspiracy theories and it's just a straight fact. You're either for God, and if you're not for him, you are against him, because not to be against him means that you're really for him. There is no sort of fence to sit on with God. So he loves his enemies because he loves those who are against him. He loves those who are not even for him. He loved me when I wasn't for him. He loves you if you're not for him. And he loves you knowing everything about even what you think of him. So you'd think, wouldn't you, that if we're going to look at a toxic colleague, that we might focus in on what we know Jesus says about loving your enemies. And we might end up saying, well, you've got to be really nice to a toxic colleague, and you've got to think lovely, sweet thoughts about them, and you've got to just, like, you know, give them cake and all that. And sometimes that can, you know, be short-term effective. But if there's somebody in your workplace who is just the kind of person who has completely altered the way a team works, the way a department works, who alters working relationships in a way that is merely manipulative and self-centered, if you've got somebody in your work team who actually gets off on making other people miserable, and there are people like that in the world, you know, we might not think so, we might want to bend over backwards and give everybody the benefit of the doubt. There are people around, and they're employed, so they crop up in workplaces, who really get off on making everybody else feel miserable. It's just a power thing. It's just a control thing. It just gives them pleasure. If you've got somebody like that, you know, cake might make you feel better about yourself. It's not going to change them. So Jesus is not giving us a recipe. When he talks about loving your enemies, he's not giving you a recipe for useless niceness, which will not help you endure. It really won't. He's not giving a recipe, though, for useless niceness. He's talking about a point you get to because you've got a relationship with God. And it's what that relationship with God does for you that helps you to do what Jesus said. And that's why Psalm 9 is not remotely at odds with what Jesus said. Psalm 9, and there's loads of other psalms like them, not just from David, but there are lots and lots of these psalms, the boffins call them imprecatory psalms, where you're really just asking God to deal with your enemy. These psalms are not counter to what Jesus said. We don't have, you know, nasty, brutal stuff in the Old Testament, and then Jesus comes along all lovely and sweet and nice and gets rid of all that. Not at all. Not at all. Just as the Old Testament leads up to Christ for all its fulfillment, so in the same sort of manner, it's the kind of thing that you can say because of Psalm 9 that gets you to the point where you can do what Jesus says when he says, love your enemies. Because you're not trying to love your enemy and substitute love for niceness or something like that. Love is not that sort of pretending thing. Love is not superficial. Love is not just cake. But cake can be, all right, I'm not knocking cake. Honest, I'm not. And if you've got any, I'll prove to you that I would never knock cake. Particularly if it's a lemon drizzle cake, by the way, but that's easy to prove. What Jesus is talking about when he talks about loving your enemies is real world, true, gritty, raw life. And that's where Psalm 9 is. And it's when you go through the realism of Psalm 9 that you can then really love your enemies without pretending that they're not really your enemy. Or without trying to sweep the hurts under the carpet, because if you try and do that, they won't disappear. So what Psalm 9 does, and there are many psalms like it, we're going to pick many others, what Psalm 9 does is it stops, if you get Psalm 9, you have a way of not, now this is the kind of language we use nowadays, not bottling it up, not internalizing the hurt and the offense that a toxic colleague can cause. Not trying to push it underground, because if you do that, it might look like it's gone away, but all you've done is poison the soil. And then everything that grows from it will be ruined. It'll crop up all over the place in you. If you try and bury it, it'll just corrupt you. So what the Psalms like this do is they show you that when you've got God in your life, you can actually deal with what it's doing to you, what a toxic colleague is doing to you, without you going and punching their lights out, because you'll lose it one day because you've been burying it up until then. Or finding that your relationships with lots of other people are getting poisoned because you've tried to put it underground. And all you've done is poison the soil. So what Psalm 9 does is it gives you real help in the real world so that then you can really love your enemies without mangling your brain and playing little psychobabble tricks on yourself to tell you that they're not really your enemies, they're really quite nice, when in reality they're not. So, five benefits in Psalm 9, five benefits of having God in your life. God who's not sort of, you know, pie in the sky, sweet stuff, you know, heavenly granddad kind of figure. Be careful what I say, because there's quite a lot of granddads here today. You know, just, you know, not that kind of sweet mythical thing that the Bible never actually talks about, but a real God who understands real life and is with us in it. Five benefits. First is you can let off steam. If you've got God in your life, you've got the ultimate pressure valve. And if you're facing somebody who is perpetually mean, nasty, belittling, manipulative, who can do office politics in their sleep, you know, just all that stuff comes naturally to them. They're just so clever at doing it. A word here, a word there, a look, a little whisper. You know, how it's just so horrible. And you're useless at that kind of thing. You can't do that kind of thing. You're just plain and straightforward. And it builds up and builds up. And if you don't have a pressure valve, it's that rage or anger or hurt or whatever it is going to come out on the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the toxic person will laugh their socks off watching you do it. So you need a pressure valve. And the pressure valve, the ultimate pressure valve, is God. Why? Because he can take everything that you fling at him. He is big enough to take everything that you fling at him. And not one thing you say is going to surprise him, because he knows it already. He knows it already. So you're not going to pray. I mean, you know, you imagine there's David's praying away, and he's praying all this stuff, and he's saying, you know, particularly, arise, Lord, do not let mortals triumph, let the nations be judged. The wicked are in sin, the wicked go down to the realm, all this kind of thing. We shouldn't imagine that somehow or another David is saying the wrong thing here, and that God's going to say, I didn't think you were like that, David. I'm so shocked to hear you say that. That's not the kind of thing I'd expect, you know. He knows, God knows it all. So you need a pressure valve, and the pressure valve is not anybody else in the office. And the pressure valve is not the toxic colleague either. And the pressure valve is not your family. And it's not the cat, do not kick the cat. It's not the cat's fault. The pressure valve is not the other people on the road in the journey home in the car. The pressure valve is God, because he can take it. And he already knows. And he already loves you. You need a pressure valve. And it needs not to be other people around. You need a pressure valve, and it's God. So one of the things that David is doing in these Psalms is he is, if nothing else, he is letting off steam before he explodes. So those of you who have ever used a pressure cooker and have been rather nervous about the pressure cooker, and if you had one of those old ones which had the pressure valve with the different coloured stripes on it, and you wondered, oh no, if it goes red, does it mean the whole thing's going to blow up? And instead of attending to it, you run out of the kitchen fast. You'll know what a pressure valve is for. Second, what is God doing here? What is David doing here? He is speaking to God, and from God, he is receiving terrific, here's the word, stamina. You get great stamina. Look at verse 13. Lord, see how my enemies persecute me. Have mercy and lift me up from the gates of death, that I may declare your praises in the gates of daughter Zion. What's going on? This opposition, this oppression, these enemies are doing him in. He's not unrealistic about his own condition. He is down, and he's heading out. Have mercy and lift me up from the gates of death, that I may what? That I may have a future. That I may declare your praises in the gates of daughter Zion. Two places to go. Death. Or a place to go and worship God. Daughter Zion. You see what David has got here from God? He's got the stamina to endure because God, he can turn to God and ask for a different future from the one that the enemies are creating for him. It just gives him hope. It gives him endurance. It gives him stamina. And sometimes if you've got a toxic colleague and it's destroying things, you'll know what it's like. You just need stamina. You just want to give in. You don't want to go into work that day. You think, oh, no, I can't do this anymore. I can't go on like this. But you've got to. Like, who else is going to pay your mortgage? And you think, is it right that I should just... No, why should they win? You need stamina. You need somebody who can give you hope because they can work in a way that gives you a different future from the one that the bad person is creating. You need stamina. In here. Third, he gets internal help from the one who knows everything. Now, we've been hinting at it already, letting off steam and getting stamina and that kind of thing. But the point is that what David is experiencing as he speaks to God so honestly and so carefully in Psalm 9, even though he's sort of letting off both barrels, is he's getting internal strength without internalizing the problem. Now, before ever a problem with a toxic colleague gets solved, and 9 times out of 10 it gets solved actually out of the blue, because they just get moved somewhere. But before ever the solution actually happens, you need internal help. And you need internal help not to just absorb it and bottle it up and keep it all inside. You need somebody you can talk to. Somebody who understands. Not just letting off steam, but you need somebody who just receives what you say without whacking you. And without trying to, quotes, just put you right. You need internal help from somebody who understands. And there is nobody who understands toxicity. There is nobody who understands poisoned speech, cunning, manipulative plotting. There is nobody who understands hatred. There is nobody who understands evil better than God, who totally understands it. And there is nobody who understands how you feel when you're getting rejected even though you're doing the right thing than God, because that's what happens to him. So when you've got God in your life, you can talk to somebody who really, really understands the problem in a way that nobody else you know can understand you. Fourth, what he gets to do is you get to let go of something before justice is done. Because you leave the just thing to God. What do I mean? You know how we often say, well, you've got to forgive somebody, you've got to forgive. And we do that. But our problem is that in our Western world, we can be too flippant and too easy about forgiveness. We can be too superficial about forgiveness. And we can think that if you just say, I forgive you, then you have actually forgiven them. But you can come out with the words, but actually forgiveness is not an easy, flippant thing. If forgiveness is easy and casual, it isn't forgiveness. Why? Because forgiveness requires justice to be done. There is a justice element in the forgiveness process, and if it's not there, then forgiveness can be talked about, you can use the word, you can think you're doing it, and you will discover in 5-6 months' time it didn't happen. Because you still hate them. That's why in some African countries like Rwanda, what got set up was called a truth and justice or a truth and reconciliation commission. You can't have the reconciliation that forgiveness brings unless there is truth being spoken and acknowledged. If somebody never acknowledges that they've hurt you, you can talk about forgiveness, you can say you forgive them, but forgiveness itself can't happen because there is no acknowledgement. So we experience God's forgiveness when we repent. We experience forgiveness from God because justice was done. Christ paid the price for our sins. Now, how that works out in life is, well, you say, well, how can I ever forgive somebody? How can I forgive my enemies if my enemies never say they're my enemies? Well, that deep forgiveness might never actually happen in life. Don't kid yourself. But what you can do, and this is different from forgiveness, what you can do is let go of the offense. You just let go. And the only way you can let go is if you know that at some point, in some way, justice will be done. Forgiveness that is easy and superficial is forgiveness that is divorced from justice and is very difficult morally to square. And we feel that, don't we? So you hear people say, well, I've forgiven him. Sort of. I've forgiven him. I wring his neck, but I've forgiven him. Yeah, there's a justice thing in the forgiveness process. And if the justice isn't there, forgiveness isn't really forgiveness. But you can let go. You can make a decision in your own heart that you're just not going to be defined by that. You're not going to be ruled by that. You're not going to be corrupted by it. You're not going to let what they've done shape you. You're just going to let go and move on. And hey presto, you can. You can. If you know deep down that God's going to deal with the justice issue, and you can't because you're powerless or they disappear, but God can. Fifth, David experiences, because he has God in his life, he experiences, if you like, a reminder that he is not the center of the universe. If you've got somebody like a toxic colleague at work or in some other part of your life, he can fill you with so much confusion and hurt and frustration and bewilderment and whatever that you can actually become totally absorbed in yourself and how you feel. And one of the impacts is that it turns you into somebody who, with the best will in the world, you've become the center of your own universe because you've become absorbed by what they're doing to you and your powerlessness in the situation. You've just effectively become absorbed by yourself. If you've got God in your life, then like David, you're going to say, I will give thanks to you, Lord, with all my heart. I will tell of your wonderful deeds. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing the praises of your name, O Most High. Because you know that you're not the center of the universe. It gives you a sense of proportion. Having God in your life, God gives you a sense of proportion and perspective. And compassion has room to grow then. Because there's more space on the canvas than just your anger, pain, frustration. You see, the canvas is bigger than your own feelings at the moment. You see the bigger picture. So your sense of proportion and perspective are restored. There's room for compassion, and you can behave with some poise in the office, or the classroom, or the staff room, or wherever it is. You get some poise because somebody in your life is bigger than the universe, and definitely bigger than your toxic colleague, and bigger than the problem. And it just restores your poise and your equilibrium. And then you don't go in to work each morning already tensed for the fight and liable to go off the handle at any minute, or just capitulate and fold and go home. You can let off steam. You get the stamina. You have a conversation with somebody in your heart who understands. You can let go of the offense even before justice is done. And you get help keeping a sense of proportion. I don't know, I really don't know how some people cope with the toxic colleagues that they have to. I've watched some people try and fail. And you look at the situation and you have to say, the poison won. That's what it makes you think. But I've seen people cope with it with God in their lives. And they've coped with it incredibly well. Let's pray.